It's time now for KMTS Connections, a public affairs program from KMTS News, heard weekdays around 12:30, bringing you interviews and information regarding nonprofit events and city and county services from Aspen to Rifle. KMTS Connections connects you to everything that matters in the Roaring Fork Valley and beyond. Once again, it's Gabe from the KMTS Morning Show, and it's, I guess you might call this the KMTS Wildfire Summit 2014. We've got same players. We actually did this around this time last year. We'll be talking about wildfire season, the forecast for this year, and maybe some things that you can do to help make your home, even the community, a little bit safer. We've got Ron Biggers from the Glenwood Fire Department, who kind of put together today's panel, if you will. Jim Pokran from the Colorado River Water Conservation District, and Kelly Rogers from the Colorado State Forest Service. Also joining us on the phone today is a lady who has been in the studio in the past. It's Molly Mowry, and her program is Fire Adapted Communities Learning Network, and she couldn't make it in here. She's based in the on the Front Range, and so we're going to be visiting with her as well, and she might jump in also from time to time. I'm going to start with Jim Pokran again. Jim, all of this, it, at least in my mind, seems to come from the water that we get the previous winter and how many grasses and trees grow and then what happens when they start drying out in the summer.
For sure. Water is a fundamental predictor of the fire season, although it's not the only one, but it certainly sets the pace more or less. So if we look back to last fall, we were getting good rains. We had good monsoon season, and then everybody knows what happened in September on the Front Range, and we were getting wet here too, even right on through to October. Nobody was sure what kind of snow year we were going to have. They certainly didn't predict what we got, and what we got was, depending where you are in the basin, 120 to 140%. So antecedent to where we are right now are good soil moistures and a good snowpack, and of course we're now into runoff. But even during a good runoff, if it stops raining in the early spring, things can dry out pretty fast. But we were fortunate that in May we got continued precipitation, and it's been a well above average through May and even up to this point. And a lot of people might remember that Memorial Day was a little bit chilly and wet.
And actually, we even had, I think, some snow in the mountains the second weekend of June.
Correct. Yeah, we've been getting the high mountain snows right past the point that we're used to seeing them. But it's all good.
Ron, from a fire mitigation standpoint, is it harder to have a conversation with people about fire mitigation when they see the snow on the mountains, they see the Colorado River, the Roaring Fork River, Frying Pan, Crystal, and they're all near bank full or close to flood stage?
Yeah, it is, because that's all we hear on the media, of how great our snowpack is and all that, which is fine. But it's a double-edged sword. If you go around our valley, we've had a bumper crop of cheatgrass growing and other grasses, other fine fuels. I was out at Canyon Creek yesterday looking at some home sites for property owners about doing some mitigation. And the cheatgrass out there is just all over, and it's about 6 to 8 inches high, and it's curing out. It's drying out. So as Jim said, it helps our live fuels have more moisture in them, but then some of these fine fuels that once the moisture goes away, they dry out and cure out. So they will carry fire very well. And grass fires can get in then to your canopies and your trees and that vegetation. Plus, there's areas, you know, the plains of our state, which, and probably down where Kelly is, you know, Grand Junction area, where it's a little flatter and that. Grass is a big danger. Oklahoma loses homes. Texas loses homes with a lot of low flammable vegetation.
Well, I want to say almost half the state is on the plains in the Front Range outside of Denver there. And speaking of not necessarily Grand Junction, but just a little south of Grand Junction, southwestern Colorado, that would be the San Juan River Basin, is the only river basin in Colorado that is not above the 100, it is not above 100% of the 30-year average, right, Jim?
Right. It certainly bears pointing out that we're an island of bounty here, but southwestern Colorado did not get what we got. It improved in late spring, but they're still behind. And we should be mindful too that we're citizens of all the West, and everybody knows what the situation is in California. They're still in a dire situation out there.
And I know for the last several months, at the state level, the governor actually convened the Colorado Water Conservation District, and they've been having meetings, I want to say every month, to try and put together a water plan for the Colorado River in Colorado, at least our portion of it, which I guess technically would be the upper Colorado, right?
Yeah, correct. From a water supply perspective, what you're alluding to is the fact that Colorado's population is supposed to double by 2050, and we only have the same amount of water molecules that we've always had. They just keep moving from the ground to the sky and back. So the question is, if Colorado is truly going to have 5 million more people, how are they going to have water coming out of their spigots? And there are a couple of ways for that to happen, and one is what's already happened. It's being taken out of agriculture. We're kind of drifting off the fire subject here, but since you asked. Yeah.
It does all come into play, though, really.
Yeah, certainly if ag lands are dried up, which is what's happening primarily on the Front Range, that could be a potential fire issue when they're just left to weeds and you lose the irrigation. The focus would be on more water development out of the Colorado River for a big Trans Mountain diversion from West Slope to the Front Range, which we already have numerous of those that take over a lot of water. So, some would think that that's still a good idea. So what the governor did was he created a deadline with an executive order issued in 2013 that the basin roundtables, which is what state legislation created to have an expansive grassroots discussion of these issues. And so we're furiously writing right now because we have a deadline of end July to submit a draft. And there'll be eight draft plans from different basins in the state. I'll have to synthesize what this is about. But the whole goal is to have a balanced water supply future.
I don't know. We're really off topic because we're talking about population and population shifts, too. By the Colorado Natural Hazards Mitigation Plan, as Jim was alluding to, the predicted population is to rise to 6.2 million in just about 6 years, 2020, and 7.3 million by 2030. Now, the fastest growing area is our area, the Western Slope. The prediction there is will grow at a rate of 2.65% between 2010 and 2020. So we're almost halfway there through that period as well, where the rest of the state's growth rate is only at 1.8%. And so the water issue taps into, and like Molly's topics there with fire-adapted communities, of planning these communities to have water not only for their drinking and domestic needs, but for our purposes, not only while firefighting, but structural firefighting and other needs that you need. So it ties into, when you get into the population shifts and changes, of how are we going to design our subdivisions in the future to make them safer places, not only for citizens, but for the residents that live there. Since about 58-60% of all our land in the state is privately owned, so it's developable.
One of the keys to what Ron's talking about is how this future development is going to be landscapes, because from a water supply standpoint, the real big water use is going to be the urban irrigation footprint. So if people want wall-to-wall bluegrass in their yards, that's an issue, especially on the Front Range where they'll be asking for more West Slope water. So do we want West Slope water to go to wall-to-wall carpeting on the Front Range? But how this, as Ron's alluding to, the other pieces, how are these new outdoor landscapes going to look?
I think that this is a great topic because there are a lot of design elements in terms of community development that we often don't think about when we're considering new developments, but they do relate to wildfire risk. And, Ron's absolutely right that as population increases along the western slope, it's very likely a lot of these communities will be considered what we call built in the wildland-urban interface, which means they create a dynamic with, the existing conditions of wildfire risk, and you put people there, and all of a sudden you have, more issues and more resources needed, unless we look at how to develop those communities more in harmony with the natural environment, using the right materials, looking at the types of access required, looking at the landscape that was just pointed out. And so there are a number of features we can be thinking about, but it's possible. It's just we haven't yet gotten to the point of always including that kind of thinking in our development decisions yet.
And that's one of your big focuses with the Fire Adapted Communities Learning Network, is trying to educate folks as to all of those options that they have available to them, right?
Yes, exactly. So just to take a step back with what the network is, the Fire Adapted Communities Learning Network is part of a larger movement, if you will, called Fire Adapted Communities. And, the thinking in the last couple of years at the policy and the national level has really shifted from this idea that, it's the homeowner's responsibility alone or it's the firefighter's responsibility alone, that there needs to be greater awareness for what everyone's role is in wildfire risk reduction and taking action. So taking a number of steps that go beyond just individual lots, but looking at the community as a whole, looking at the surrounding landscape, how do we manage both together with wildfire in mind? And so the network was formed. It's managed by the Watershed Research and Training Center out of California and the Nature Conservancy, and they work in coordination with the U.S. Forest Service. So the network was formed a few years ago with this idea that we take a series of pilot communities around the country, three of which are in Colorado, and work with some specific leading organizations to work within the communities around them and spread this knowledge and thinking about what it takes to become more fire adapted at the local level. So it's not a top-down process, driven by decisions that someone else is making from some other area. It's really designed to be a grassroots-focused project that targets, how can folks at the local level decide what's best for them in their communities, understanding there's a number of actions that communities can take beyond simply, one audience or audience-specific only targeting the homeowner, for instance, or only targeting one specific sector.
And one of those lead agencies for fire-adapted communities in Colorado is the Colorado State Forest Service, and we'll talk with Kelly Rogers from the State Forest Service in just a couple minutes. You're listening to KMTS Connections. Welcome back to KMTS Connections. Again, it's the, I don't know why I keep calling it this, the 2014 KMTS Wildland Fire Summit. We're kind of on the subject of fire-adapted communities. Molly Mowry from Fire Adapted Communities Learning Network in Denver is joining us on the phone today. And before the break, she kind of explained what fire-adapted communities is all about. And she made it a point, we actually talked about this before we went on the air. I asked, okay, whose project is this? And she said, well, it's not really any one organization. It's more of a movement as opposed to, a tried and true list of rules that everyone has to follow and they send down the mandate from Washington, D.C. or Los Angeles or New York or Denver, and then everybody has to follow them. And again, the Forest Service, the U.S. Forest Service, is a big partner in fire-adapted communities. But here in Colorado, Colorado State Forest Service also has a lot of resources and has been participating in this program for a while. And Kelly Rogers from the Grand Junction office of the Colorado State Forest Service is here. And Kelly, fire-adapted communities, to put it in a nutshell, based on what Molly just said, really is ways for organizations like the State Forest Service to get together with not only private landowners, but other governmental entities and political subdivisions, if you will, to try and mitigate wildland fire. In other words, find ways that when the fires do happen, try and keep them under control as quickly as possible, or keep the houses out of harm's way, or provide that, I guess it all comes down to defensible space, huh?
Well, yeah, it does come down to defensible space, but as Molly had mentioned earlier, you know, it's more than just individual homes. We're trying to take an approach where, you know, it's the entire community that needs to become more aware and try to participate in their own defense, so to speak, in terms of wildfire hazard. You know, earlier we had talked, we've been talking about water supply. We've been talking about, you know, population growth, and those are important topics. The wildland-urban interface is certainly growing in Colorado. I don't think that's any big secret. But, you know, one of the additional challenges that we deal with almost constantly with the State Forest Service is trying to retrofit, you know, communities and subdivisions that have sprung up in the past to make them more fire adapted. It's a particular problem because, you know, you see a lot of vegetation in those areas that has grown up between homes that acts as really important privacy, and people get really attached to that. And, you know, there's just a particular challenge in retrofitting sometimes and making, you know, existing subdivisions more fire ready.
Ron was talking earlier about what he called fine fuels, or what you, I guess, would both call fine fuels in your lines of work. And you're talking about the grasses and stuff that grows quickly when there's enough water supply, but also turns brown and dries out quickly when that water supply goes away. It seems to me like a lot of the things you're talking about between houses and that kind of thing would fall into that category.
Yeah, a lot of that does. We've a lot of times with new development, what we're seeing is areas that have been traditionally agriculture-based, you know, domestic livestock grazing and that sort of thing being converted into subdivisions. So all of a sudden you've got a change in the vegetation and how it's being utilized. So that can be a real problem too. You know, all of a sudden you've got houses springing up in what used to be rangeland and pasture, and, you know, all of a sudden the grass is 4 feet tall in the middle of July, and it can pose a significant hazard in a place that you didn't really suspect had that sort of hazard in the past. So, yeah, the fuel regimes can change, and, you know, it happens really fast too. I mean, Jim alluded to the water supply, and it looks like we're in pretty good shape for this year. And the prediction is for a normal, quote-unquote, fire season. But, you know, my experience after 20-some years living in western Colorado is that it takes about maybe 2 weeks of, you know, no significant rainfall or no good wetting rain to get us right back into a high-hazard situation.
And it's right this time of year when that typically happens, too.
Yeah, I always look at, you know, historically the 2 weeks before and the 2 weeks after the 4th of July is when we really are at risk over here in western Colorado, and it seems like every year, regardless of the spring and the snowpack or whatever, we will have a fire season, we will dry out, and it'll get warm, and it really just depends on when we start getting that seasonal monsoon flow as to the real severity of our fire season.
Your comments are especially poignant considering the upcoming 20th anniversary of the Storm King fire.
Mm-hmm.
What are some things that a homeowner can do to protect their house from wildfire, Kelly?
Well, one of the biggest things we point at is the concept of defensible space. You know, not necessarily a clear cut, but an area around your home that's reduced fuel density where, you know, the fire department can safely access and defend a structure. You know, we talk about having a 10-foot clearance with all vegetation, and then trying to do more crown clearance and pruning to reduce ladder fuels and clumping up the fuels and brush, basically trying to get some separation so that you don't have this continuous fuel right up to a structure. Secondly, you know, we really point at homeowners looking at the ignitability of their home. You know, in a lot of cases, it's not this big flaming front that's going to ignite a house. It's the ember storm in a wildfire. And thinking about, you know, where are embers going to land, what is ignitable on your home, especially wood roofs and decking, you know, and checking little things like firewood storage, debris in gutters, and even, you know, wooden privacy fences in some cases can act as a significant source of fuel in a wildfire event. And, you know, thirdly, looking at water supply, trying to make sure that in the case of a wildfire, you may have a good draft source for the fire department nearby, and realizing that a lot of times, you know, electric pumps and generators may not be working during a fire event. You know, the first thing that goes out a lot of times is the electric lines either arc or get burned up, and all of a sudden you've got no electricity. Generators as a backup can work, but there's got to be somebody there to start it usually and keep fuel in it and that kind of thing. So not always the best solution there for water supply. Another thing is improving access, you know, driveways, access roads. Again, doing some thinning of the vegetation and providing pullouts and posting addresses, those kind of issues can really improve your situation. And lastly, just being ready to evacuate, you know, getting essentials together so that you can leave your home quickly.
And one thing that I've been learning more and more and appreciating is building relationships and encouraging homeowners to talk to one another, talk to the fire department, know what to expect or not expect, talk to other community members. If there's something that you want to change in your community, it needs to be addressed. You know, start the movement and become a spark plug. What we see around the country is the most prepared communities are the ones with the active and passionate people doing something and getting together in groups and making it happen. And I think, you know, building that capacity at the local level just can't be underestimated, the power that you can have with that.
And kind of like a neighborhood watch, really knowing your neighbors and that kind of thing is really a good thing, even when we're talking about wildland fire. Not only from a fire standpoint, but, you know, if you see one of your neighbors leave the house and you know the other one is typically there during the day and they haven't left yet, maybe they haven't heard an evacuation notice or something like that. Plus, looting is also an issue sometimes when you get fire in urban areas. And if you know your neighbors, you know who's supposed to be in your neighborhood, you can help law enforcement from that standpoint as well.
To piggyback on that, you know, Gabe and Molly, your HOA, if you're in a subdivision that has an HOA, especially like Kelly was talking about, some of the older ones, it may be time for a group to revisit their design guidelines for what can be built in that subdivision. And for the newer homes, if there are still lots available that can come in, if they're in a wildfire interface area, like in Glenwood where we have our maps that show who's in high area, plus the insurance companies do as a side point, your HOA may have to catch up with more current information in that. You know, you'd be surprised you go around. There's still HOAs that have in there, you got to put a shake roof on, or you need to do certain types of vegetation, which may be more combustible. And those changes, if the homeowners as a group get together, those things can be modified and changed. And what happened, like in Boulder, which was one of the front-running counties many, many years ago, when they started aggressively mitigating stuff, that's one of their methods was to, if one homeowner did work, to speak to the next homeowner. Because unless a significant number of people in the subdivision do work to reduce the whole fire danger in their area, then the onesie-twosies are going to be limited in what their efforts are going to do.
Haven't we talked about in the past, haven't you heard some rumblings from insurance adjusters that they might start looking at the houses in the wildland-urban interface more like they look at houses that are, say, close to a river and start looking at fire insurance similar to the way that they look at flood insurance?
Yes, it's been spoken in some conversations I have with insurance people that, you know, Colorado is, we're kind of on a fine line because not only do we have wildfire, which is our main natural disaster over here on the western slope, but the Front Range, you've got hail, you've got tornadoes, and those events thrown in with wildfire. So we have a lot of areas that are at risk, and homeowners and insurance companies, as everybody knows, they're in business to make money. Mm-hmm. And if they don't want to assume your risk or want to jack your prices up, they'll do that very easily. And they're way out ahead of the fire service and other mitigation, emergency management, mapping techniques and all. The bigger companies have our country mapped and rated. And so now an agent can pull up that map and say, Gabe, oh, your house is in a wildfire-prone area. If we're going to keep you on, you either need to do this or that to it, or we'll up your deductible, or we'll just say, fine, it's been nice. Go find
Thanks
another
for the premiums
insurance
over
company.
The years.
Right.
We're already seeing that along the Front Range. There's a number of folks living more in the mountain communities that are receiving letters from very different insurance agents with different information, so it's not necessarily consistent on what that is or what the action items are, but it is happening in the state. And I think it is bringing some folks to action, but, you know, if you can get ahead of that and take action before that and be more proactive, you're going to be in a better spot than simply reacting to the letter that you get in the mail.
And the first step, at least easiest step, is actually checking out some websites. I know Fire Adapted Communities has a website which folks can check out, right, and learn more about a lot of the stuff we talked about today, Molly?
That's correct. You can go to fireadapted.org, and there's some great resources on there according to, you know, whether you're a homeowner, a first responder, a land manager. I think that's a great place to start. It will link you to a number of other programs, whether it's FireWise or Ready, Set, Go, or other different agencies that would be helpful to connect with. So fireadapted.org is the website.
All right, and again, resources not just for homeowners or for emergency responders, but kind of resources for everyone. Again, keying on the word communities in Fire Adapted Communities program. We'll take one final break. When we come back, we'll give you contact information for everybody that we spoke with today and wrap things up. You're listening to KMTS Connections. Welcome back to KMTS Connections. Again, we're visiting with Ron Biggers from the Glenwood Fire Department, Kelly Rogers from the Colorado State Forest Service, Molly Mowry from Fire Adapted Communities Learning Network, and Jim Pokran from the Colorado River Water Conservation District. Again, wildfire is a way of life in Colorado. It has been ever since Colorado has existed, long before people were here, I'm sure, and continues to be as time moves on. One of the interesting things that we did not talk about earlier, we did spend a reasonable amount of time on water, and something I always find interesting is we always talk about, you know, Ron kind of called out the media, and I guess that's Yeah, okay, whatever. It's all our fault. But there is a lot of emphasis on what we, you know, the snowpack, and we quantify the snowpack in terms of the 30-year average. Where now, for those of us that have lived in Colorado all our life, we realize that that 30-year average is now a pretty dry 30-year average. And so how does that play into the water situation in Colorado, not just from wildfires, but from all of these other treaties and agreements that we have to abide by?
Well, the last time that Lake Powell was full, which is a good predictor of what kind of water situation we're in.
Let me guess. About 15 years ago?
If that's 1999.
Yeah.
There you go. So the last time Lake Powell was full was 1999, and ever since that point, we've been in a long-term drought, even though we've had good snow years like 2005, 2011, and now this year, it's still a pattern of long-term drought. So hopefully, maybe we'll have a couple years looking like this, and things will turn around. But if you remember, even after 2011, 2012 was the fourth worst snowpack on record, and that was going to be a bad fire year. 2013 was heading in the same direction. Thankfully, we got late season precipitation and turned that around, not only from a moisture in the landscape situation, but from a water supply crisis. And then we lucked out this year. But as you alluded earlier, yes, there are legal obligations that we must abide by the Colorado River Compact 1922. About 70% of what flows by in the river needs to go out of state in the Colorado River system to satisfy our obligations to three other upper basin states and the three lower basin states. So the numbers, when you look at the bigger picture, the numbers aren't really turning around. Lake Powell's inflow is going to be about 105% of average this year. And you say, well, how could that be true when we're at 120, 130%? You got to remember that we're an island of bounty in this basin right now, as I said earlier, and not all parts of Colorado. You alluded to San Juan, but there's also Utah, Wyoming, and other states in the basin. When you put it all together, inflows are going to be 105% of average. So long-term drought is still staring us in the face. And I'd like to come back to one more thing that the other folks were talking about. Another link between water supply and fire is watershed health. And most of our water supply is generated in the wildlands. And as Denver Water learned so many years ago, when the wildfire, and I think it was the Hayman fire, burns through your watershed, there's a big price to pay for danger in your water supply. You get a lot of runoff going straight into the reservoir. And that was their case. They spent a lot of money cleaning out one of their reservoirs. So part of the water plan we discussed earlier is going to start taking up that subject of watershed health, and that's something that our firefighting friends might want to be mindful of.
Sure. And, Jim, if anyone is listening right now and would like more information about the Colorado River Water Conservation District, or I believe it was 2 years ago, you celebrated a big milestone, and there was somebody loaned me a copy of it's great just for the history, to read about the history of the Colorado River and the river district.
You know, Gabe, we've turned you into a water geek. it's a beautiful thing. Yeah, we were 75 years old two years ago when we put out a history of our organization, and it's really a history of the West because water is the West. And that book is still available. And you can learn more about that book and our organization and make contact with us through our website at www.coloradoriverdistrict.org.
Coloradoriverdistrict.org, again, is that website. Ron Biggers, Jim made a good point. 2012, we were all very concerned about the wildfire season that year. We dodged a bullet, as he said, and yet every bullet that we dodge, there are more of those, as you would call them, fine fuels and grasses that continue to grow that then are going to be brown again in another week or two.
Correct. And like when I've been on shows before, Gabe, I still like to use the analogy, since everybody's a football fan and Colorado seems to be anyway. The huddle. This is the time if we have a short fire season. The past years, at least on the western slope, we haven't had too much activity. This is the time for people to do the measures that Kelly has talked about. It's the time for HOAs to get together and do their projects and get the stuff done because, you know, it's 360. At some point in time, it's going to turn, and as we've said in this business for a long time, it's not if, it's when. And so that's the thing with the water situation. We can't control that. We've said, too, in the wildfire business, we can't control the weather, but we can control what we do on topography, as Molly has alluded, in planning. In those areas, we can do things in to get ready. One other point I want to make is we're not saying that people can't build in the interface. There are just more wiser and prudent ways to build in the interface and make them safe. And that's not only safe for the residents and that they'll have a home to come back to, it makes it safe for the firefighters. You alluded to coming up here in a few weeks. We'll have our 2020 anniversary for a very sad day for wildfire communities. And in a week or so, they'll probably, unfortunately, have a similar ceremony from a one-year anniversary down in the Yarnell and Prescott area. And so times, I would hope, will start to change where these communities will be built safe. We will not be putting firefighters, which in, since I'm part of that community, our values at risk. We evacuate people out because it's not safe for them to be in there.
And then you go right back in and fight the fire.
We want to put humans in there to try and control an event that they can't really control. So if you make your home and your community safer, and as Kelly was saying, defensible, that means that we can go in there and safely defend your home. Put out the embers that may start in an area. Put out a small spot fire. But we're not going to be in there to try and stop a fire that's coming through the treetops. And the older homes, again, in retrofitting them, people remodel. They can remodel the exterior, too, if they plan to be there for a while.
And you probably the local fire department representative, just like when there is a fire, you're going to be the first best resource for many folks. So obviously you represent the Glenwood Fire Department, so anybody living in those boundaries can give you a call and you can actually go out and visit with them and talk about things that they might be able to do to help make their home or their subdivision more defensible. But you also have contacts with other fire marshals and other resources that may be available to folks, right?
Correct, Gabe. We've done a good job here, I think, in Glenwood of getting grant funds to help, again, individual homeowners do stuff. I'm in the process now of being reviewed for some FEMA funds that would be doing some things on a bigger scope if we can get into that pool of money. But, yeah, we do home site visits and can coach people on what they need to do. I do have some BLM funds since Kelly's money's dried up from the state forest to do the 50-50 cost share funds to help people do that. And I'm also interested if there's people out there, like Molly was talking, would like to get together and form a group that could speak more to these issues and work on Glenwood area and the subdivisions around the Glenwood area anyway of becoming more fire adapted because there are technologies and there's things that they can do.
Again, Ron's number is 384-6433 if you want to give him a call and talk about anything we talked about today. Kelly Rogers from the State Forest Service in Grand Junction. I'm not going to ask you to tell us your email address because I know it's really long because it's a CSU email, which I know from 4-H interviews in the past is quite involved.
Right.
But if folks would like more information from you or the State Forest Service, what is the best way to get a hold of you and have that conversation?
We're always available to do site visits with homeowners. You can reach us either by just doing a search on the internet for Colorado State Forest Service. That'll pull up our page, and you can go to our local webpage. There's a wealth of information on fire-adapted communities, you know, links to FireWise practices and grant programs available. Or you can call us at our district office in Grand Junction. That number is 970-248-7325, and we'll be glad to come out and visit with you on your property. Kind of getting back to what some of the other folks here have mentioned is the idea of joining in as a community and trying to build community capacity. You know, it's great to visit one-on-one with homeowners. I like to see people doing stuff around their house to make it more fire-wise and fire-adapted. But a lot of the grant monies that Ron spoke about earlier really are targeting larger groups of people rather than just individual homeowners. And it's important if you're looking at pursuing grant funding to really pursue those projects as a larger group and as a community. That's where we're getting the biggest bang for the buck, and the grant funding is becoming a lot more competitive. And really, to compete successfully, you've got to come together as a larger group, and it just makes sense to do that.
The economies of scale and all that.
Correct.
So the more people you can get together to put together a group that will receive a grant, the better. So if it's a larger homeowners association or even folks on your block, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and it makes a lot more sense for us with the State Forest Service to come out and talk to the entire group at a homeowner association meeting or something like that rather than just the one-on-one contact. I mean, we like doing all that public outreach, but it's much more effective if you can possibly, you know, talk to your neighbors, try to build more of a sense of community, and we'll be glad to come out and talk to the whole group.
And again, that'll look better to those grantors as well if they're going to be giving money to those projects.
You bet.
Well, one final note. Ron mentioned noteworthy anniversaries. What I saw last June 2nd was pretty memorable, and that was, this escaped a lot of people's attention, the Arizona fire crew that lost so many people. It came through our county and hiked our Storm King Memorial, and I was on my way to Montrose, and I saw them marching up in formation, helmets and fully geared up, and I was just going, well, what the heck is that? And it was pretty impressive to see. And then after the tragedy happened, it was mentioned that the crew had just recently visited our memorial. So what became an item of interest became somewhat spiritual, and I'll remember that date for a long time, June 2nd.
Yeah, we all have our memories, I think, of events like that, certainly. Molly, anything else that you would like to mention? Again, fireadapted.org is the website for fire-adapted communities. And I guess the point we're trying to drive home today is resources are available. Now is the time to do something if you would like to get your neighborhood or your street, your subdivision together and just have a conversation. And it's really not that difficult or, in a lot of cases, expensive.
Yeah, I think I love Ron's football analogy of finding out, you know, not just getting the huddle together, but finding out who's in your huddle. And, you know, we've also talked about this today, that even if you don't live in the wildland urban interface, you still have a role in making your community more fire adapted. So chances are, if you're a business owner, you are going to be impacted by a local wildfire. Or if you're a community leader, decision maker, you're going to be impacted by wildfire. So we're helping with our fire adapted community message, helping everyone to see what their role is. And as you said, fireadapted.org has great ideas, as well as if you want to get more specific with some fire-adapted community topics, you can go to our blog, which is facnetwork.org. That's facnetwork.org. And there are a lot of insights, opportunities to connect with the local communities, the pilot communities that I mentioned in Colorado, and see if you want to reach out to them, get some ideas. If I could just quickly name those organizations that might be helpful. We have the Coalition for the Upper South Platte, the Summit County Wildfire Council, and Firewise of Southwest Colorado. So again, all of those organizations are taking a leadership role in their region to reach out to their communities and look at fire-adapted community actions and projects they can take. And I'm sure they'd be happy to connect with folks if you want to reach out to them for some additional thoughts and ideas. And you can find all that information on the blog, facnetwork.org.
So again, two websites there, fireadapted.org, and then the blog is facnetwork.org, facnetwork.org. Molly brought up something interesting we didn't talk about in the rest of the conversation, which is there are some resources available for businesses as well, not just individuals that want to participate in fire-adapted communities or that want to help make your business a little bit safer from wildland fire. So let me run down everybody's contact information one more time as we wrap things up. Again, Ron Biggers at the Glenwood Springs Fire Department. His number is 384-6433. It's real easy for him to make site visits, especially in if you live inside the service area for the Glenwood Fire Department. I know he works with other area fire departments as well, so he might be able to help you out or refer you to someone else in a neighboring fire district if that's appropriate. Jim Pokran from the Colorado River Water Conservation District. Their website is coloradoriverdistrict.org. And again, that 75th anniversary book is still available. Lots of pictures if you're like me and you like to look at those old pictures of, the Frying Pan Arkansas Project is mentioned in there. Ditch is mentioned in there. A lot of other things that, it's just all history. So if you're interested in history, you'll enjoy that book. Kelly Rogers at the Colorado State Forest Service. As he mentioned, if you search for Colorado State Forest Service, you can find the statewide page. And then they've got a section in there dedicated to the Grand Junction office. His number is 248-7325. As he mentioned, a lot of those grantors are going to be looking at how many people will be served by this grant. So if you can get a couple neighbors together, your street, your block, your subdivision, that's all going to help increase the chances of you receiving grants to do wildfire mitigation. Again, that number is in Grand Junction is 248-7325. And finally, Molly Mowry, Fire Adapted Communities Learning Network. Again, fireadapted.org or the blog where you'll find more information from other communities in Colorado that have adopted a lot of these things. facnetwork.org, fireadaptedcommunitiesnetwork.org. Thanks again, everybody. Appreciate it. Went over as we usually do when we talk about this subject, but that's okay.
Thank you, Gabe.
Thanks, Gabe.
I appreciate your time very much, and we'll talk to you, if not next year, sometime this summer. You've been listening to KMTS Connections, a public affairs program from KMTS News, heard weekdays around 12:30. It's another reason we are the most listened to radio station from Rifle to Aspen.